Enjoy sitting right over there.
Mr. Chairman, is this like church? You're always sitting in the back.
Yeah. You said amen.
And you notice they have all their suits on. They even, oh, even, the, that's right.
Call the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services to order, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2241. We're going to take things a little out of order of the published agenda. I would ask Jim Curtis and Grant Higginson to come forward.
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming, just tell me why Senator George is sitting way down there. Does he not want to be a part of our committee today?
I don't want to put words in his mouth. I don't
okay.
Senator, you caught me.
Go right ahead.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the acting administrator and the state health officer with the Oregon Health Division, Department of Human Services, which is the state's public health agency. And I'm here today to explain to you why we believe that there's a necessity for state licensure of outpatient renal dialysis facilities as addressed in House Bill 2241. Currently, just under about 2,000 Oregonians receive kidney dialysis treatment on an outpatient basis. And these are people who their kidneys have stopped functioning. They are medically fragile patients. If they do not get this treatment until they receive kidney transplant, they are at high risk and actually would die if they did not get this treatment. The treatment itself is relatively complex. The facilities require complicated systems as well as high-tech equipment. There needs to be critical attention to the dialysis process. There needs to be careful monitoring of patients. There need to be staff there who are able to respond to emergencies quickly. And even with all these things in place, as I mentioned, these are high-risk patients, and sometimes things do not go well. Currently in Oregon, there are 39 dialysis facilities that provide care. These facilities are concentrated in the metro area and the Willamette Valley, but particularly over recent years, there has been an expansion to other parts of the state. There are now facilities in Bend and Medford, along the coast, in Hood River, and in Ontario. Currently, there is no licensure requirement for these facilities. The only regulatory oversight is they need to be Medicaid certified, and that's a program run by the Healthcare Financing Administration, and they only have to do it if they want to receive Medicaid dollars. The Health Division has a contract with HCFA where we carry out those inspections of outpatient renal dialysis facilities. However, you need to know that the funding for this has been very erratic and unpredictable over time. As recently as just a few years ago, we only had funding to do inspections about once every 10 years, which we believe was woefully inadequate. And at the current time, we have enough funding to provide those inspections once every 3 years. But as I said, this funding level is unpredictable and erratic, and we don't know what that would look like in a few years. One thing that we have noticed over just the last few years is that we've had a dramatic increase in the number of complaints from patients and family members about dialysis care provided in these facilities. And at the same time, when we've gone out and done an investigation of those complaints, we have found in a lot of cases that those actually were founded complaints. And just to give you a couple of examples, there was one case where the facility had actually ordered the wrong solution for the dialysis machines, and it was actually incompatible for the particular machines that they were using, and consequently, a number of patients got sick, four were hospitalized, and one of those patients ended up in a critical care unit. In another case, we found that on a couple of occasions that the equipment that was used in dialysis, it needs to be cleaned each time and rinsed with a disinfectant solution, that on more than one occasion that the disinfectant solution was not adequately rinsed, and that actually can lead to blood hemolysis of the next patient who uses that machine and lead to a crisis. And actually, again, there was one case of hospitalization. So in looking at the number of complaints, looking at that have occurred over the last few years, we do think that this is something that, that does need to have more regulation than there has been in the past. And what we would suggest is to have a licensing program which would allow the health division to actually go out on an annual basis to do the inspections. Not only would we be able to do the inspections, but we would also be able to provide consultation and technical assistance to the facilities as well. What we have estimated is that a $1,500 per year annual licensing fee would give us the resources that we need to conduct this program. Over the past few years, that we have been working with the industry on this issue, and I would like to say that the industry representatives have been extremely responsive. I believe that you'll be hearing that they too see the need for a program like this and are supportive. And of course, anything that we do in the way of rules development and the implementation of the program would be in conjunction with consumer groups and with the industry to get those in place. So with that, I will end and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I really didn't have any questions. We tried to look at something like this in 1995. And the industry was not ready for it, and neither were some other people around this building. So I'm really supportive of this, and I'm very glad to see the progressive action on the part of both the industry and the health division to do something like this.
We did pass some kind of a dialysis bill, didn't we,
in the House?
In 95?
It's maybe...
Chair Fisher, it may have been the dialysis technicians bill that we approved training programs, and then we approved the certification process for technicians. But up until now, we've had nothing like it, say, in the way of licensing of these facilities.
Go ahead, sir.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Curtis. I am the area administrator for Fresenius Medical Care, a provider of dialysis services. I personally cover facilities in Portland, Salem, and Albany, Oregon. I've worked in the dialysis field for many years. In fact, my mother was the very first dialysis patient in Eugene starting in 1967, and I have been continuously involved in the providing of dialysis care to patients. The dialysis providers in this state, I believe, do a very good job, but we believe that a good cooperative working relationship between ourselves and the payers and overseers of our care simply provides for better continuity of care and more consistent provision of quality care to our patients. We are not looking forward particularly to the additional fees, but in the long run, I believe that having a good working relationship and being able to work with the health division in developing the rules for the regulation of dialysis facilities is, in the long run, a good thing that will help improve and maintain quality of care to our patients.
You now have the right to work with, do you not have the right to discipline technicians?
Chair Fisher, is that question directed to me?
Yes, I guess I would.
And I'm going to ask staff to come up to answer that. I'm not sure what we have in the way of disciplinary action.
Chairman Fisher, I apologize. I didn't hear the entire question. Could you repeat it, please?
I was just trying to ascertain what type of control or discipline you had over the hemodialysis technicians, the certified.
Can we discipline
them? And you need to identify yourself.
Yes. Chairman Fisher, for the record, my name is Kathleen Smale. I am the manager of the healthcare licensure and certification section at the health division. We regulate all of the healthcare facilities in Oregon except for long-term care facilities and laboratories. The hemodialysis technician certification program allows for us to take a number of steps. We can suspend the certification of a technician. We can revoke the certification of a technician. based on a number of things, and those are spelled out in the rules that we have filed, including problems with criminal background checks and failure to perform, et cetera.
I was just questioning because it seems like what Dr. Higginson, what you're talking about, the things that were not done, doesn't necessarily stem necessarily from clinical practice as much as from employees not doing their job with sound line or technicians.
Chair Fisher, there's more than just the technicians, though, that are involved in the care of a dialysis facility. There's the administrators of the physicians. There's nurses and other staff as well. And we continue to feel that a program that's not only licensing one of the providers of the care, but the overall facility, and to be able to work with those facilities to provide consultation and technical assistance as well as the regulatory functions is the best way to assure high-quality care.
Yeah, it just seemed to me that somebody had put the wrong fluid in a particular machine. That's not a certainly something I doubt that they receive instructions from the facility to do, or if they're not cleaning it up between times, that certainly I wouldn't think that that's a shoddy work by doing some technician doing the operation, it would seem to me.
And Chair Fisher, again, that I think that there's a number of systems issues involved, you know, not just issues with individuals, but, you know, who purchases the machine, who's checking to make sure that things have been adequately cleaned. You know, those things are dealing with systems that involve just more than one person. And again, to provide the overall systems look and consultation, as well as to have some regulatory teeth to do things when those things are not being followed, is important for a licensing program like this.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, one other question.
Senator Carter.
Dr. Kins, can you tell me in terms of your relationship, the state's relationship with HCFA, if they will be a partner in terms of the cost of doing business on this? Are you going to be trying to get National to have some kind of financial support for this program?
Chair Fisher, Senator Carter, I think the question is there a possibility of getting additional funds from the federal government to subsidize this program so it wouldn't be as much money for the facilities? Is that the question?
Exactly right.
My understanding is that, you know, HCFA sets up a payment schedule, and that is what they provide in the way of those services, and most of the patients that are seen are covered either by HCFA or by other private insurance, and so I don't believe that they would be interested in providing additional subsidies to help alleviate the cost. I think that if that's something that you were considering, that would most likely have to be at a state level rather than the national one.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Curtis, you have a small operation. How large is your operation?
I cover four facilities that provide treatments to about 350 patients.
So then, as a matter, in the course of doing business, obviously this is passed on to patients, and what kind of proposal would you have in terms of the increase in cost of doing business with?
Chairman Fisher, Senator Carter, the rates that we are allowed to charge for dialysis treatments are set by HCFA, and we cannot change those under any circumstances whatsoever. The additional costs will be borne simply by the dialysis facility.
Thank you.
Too bad our health department can't operate in that same manner. Or to share half of them.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, Senator.
How many people is going to be required for you to do this?
Chair Fisher, Senator Carter, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
How many staff people is going to be required for you to do this? It is a valuable service that we have to give to people to help monitor, you know, their care.
Right. And Senator Carter, I'll pass that over to Kathleen, who can tell you how
okay.
We came up with that.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Chairman Fisher, Senator Carter, we estimate that it will take about one FTE or less than one FTE. Some of the work might be able to be borne by existing person. For example, the management piece of it will be borne by me without any additional management staff. Okay. But it will probably take about one FTE. Because in addition to doing the annual inspections and carrying out consultation, we will also probably investigate complaints and those sorts of things as well.
Mr. Chairman, so Kathleen, the first part of the health division's piece would be the education piece in terms of what you're going to look for and how to help the business owners get ready for the things that you're looking for. I mean, the education piece is going to be so important because it hasn't happened before. Mm-hmm. And to gear the business owners up, I'm hoping, as to why I was asking that question but making a statement at the same time, that the first piece of your action is an education piece where somebody will go out and talk to people about what you're going to look for and what your expectations are through it, the administrative rules that you write up.
Chairman Fisher, Senator Carter, the first step will be to convene a task force with participation by all of the, you know, from representing all of the providers, the Board of Nursing, the other licensing boards, and so forth, to help us write rules that are realistic and can function and also achieve patient safety. Then the second, following that, then the education piece will kick in, and we will probably do a series of workshops around the state.
That's my mm-hmm. question, because right. I don't want big bad government, and I have great respect for the health division, so I know you do it, but I just want to allay the fears of our business owners that this is not something where government going to come in and step in and say you did the wrong thing, and so therefore you're sanctioned. But
right, we believe in partnership.
Right, right. Thank you.
And Chair Fisher, if I could add, if you take a look at the statute and how much the licensing fees are for other facilities, for hospitals it ranges anywhere from $750 a year to $3,400 a year. For ambulatory surgical centers, it's $1,000 a year. So we think that given the complexity of the care that's provided, that this really is consistent with the other fees that we're charging.
Yeah, just for the record, I don't see anything that says anything about education in this bill. So my guess is that any education would have to be on the goodness of your heart, because it certainly isn't in here, at least that I can see.
Chairman Fisher, if I may, it isn't in there. And it isn't in there for other provider types, but that is our standard way of doing business. We rely very much on partnership with those we regulate. The people there are on the front lines. They know what safe care involves and are a valuable resource to us. And we hope to do the same for them.
Who's investigating the complaints now?
Chairman Fisher, we are, but only under federal regulations. And one of our concerns is that the federal regulations in some areas are very, very detailed and stringent, for example, water quality. But in other areas, such as staffing, patient safety, handling of medical emergencies, the federal regulations are extremely vague. For example, there is no requirement that a registered nurse be in the building when patients are being treated, leaving the possibility that there could be one licensed practical nurse and technicians staffing the entire facility. And while I don't think that's the standard practice, the federal regulations don't preclude that.
Okay, I see Senator Dukes is here. Senator, do you wish to come in? Thank you for being patient here.
Oh, not a problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Joan Dukes, State Senator for District 1. 6 months ago, I wouldn't have cared a lot about this bill, other than the fact that it's a good bill for consumers, and I like good bills for consumers. But last October, I moved my father down to Astoria, and the doctor looked him straight in the eye and said, if you don't go on dialysis, you won't live to see summer. And my father, who felt fine, because there isn't a lot of pain in kidney disease, and was struggling with virtually no short-term memory, thought he was fine. The doctor got his point across, and he began dialysis. And I was pleased. Things went well, and we saw a lot of the symptoms lessening, and it looked good. And then I still believe that it was a personnel change that caused the change, but the manager left, and we had a new manager. And in a very short period of time, things changed dramatically. They were threatening to put my father in restraints, which made no sense. They were, without ever talking to me, thank you, and I have power of attorney, they were suddenly very concerned about his diet, and yet what they were offering him there didn't fit his diet. They were sharing medical information with people who had no right to know it, without my consent. My father had two TIAs, small strokes, while he was having dialysis, and they didn't notice. He walked in with a cane, and they wheeled him out in a wheelchair. And to protect my father's privacy, I won't tell you exactly what condition he was in when they wheeled him out, but you or I would have noticed a lot of the things that were going on. They didn't. He was taken by cab back to the retirement village that he lived in, and they noticed immediately, and he went to the hospital. I believe it's because they were taking off too much fluid. Now, that's a medical thing, and we worked that out. And, you know, it takes a while to make all of those kinds of adjustments. So I'm not critical of that. What I am critical of is that you don't notice that somebody who walks in with a cane has to be wheeled out. Their side of their mouth is drooping. They're not able to swallow. He was dehydrated. Just all kinds of things that medical personnel, if they're paying attention, ought to notice. And they had three separate complaints from staff at the retirement village and myself and somebody else over that one. But he didn't change anything. I kept asking, let me know when things are going on with my father. Give me a call. Here's how you get hold of me. Never received a call. My father's here in Salem now, and it would have been nice to have had some place to be able to call. Ultimately, I ended up talking with the regional person, director for that facility. And I have no idea what happened, although I testified in this bill in the House, and I certainly haven't had a phone call since then. But you don't come into dialysis knowing what to expect, and you're vulnerable, both the patient and the family. And I believe that we need to give them some place to go. The doctor was a help, but to a point. He had a limited amount of time. And in our case, the doctor was in Portland and coming to Astoria regularly, although there was pretty decent communication. But there was no one official I could turn to when these things happened and say, come on, help me put an end to this. This is my father we're talking about. And I'm watching him deteriorate right in front of my eyes. And I can't do anything about it except yell at them, and that didn't do me any good. So I'm asking you to pass this bill for all of those people out there who maybe don't even have a family member who's watching over them, who takes them and is willing to make those phone calls and yell. Because so many of the patients aren't able to do it for themselves. And I don't believe that my father is unique in this situation. I believe there are a lot of people out there. For whatever reason, the mix that's going on there isn't allowing them to get the kind of care that we'd like them to have.
Did you make complaints to the health division?
Only secondarily. About the same time my father was, to begin his dialysis, was admitted to a hospital, and not in Astoria, I should say. And there were a number of problems with that admission, and I called Dr. Higginson to find out where I could complain. And so as part of that, I related to them the things that were going on at the dialysis unit. But I stumbled over, even I, who think I know my way around state government, stumbled over that one. And if you need a carrier on the floor, I'd be happy.
Oh, yeah. We probably certainly could allow you to do that.
Thank you.
No, I just, I guess what I was trying to find out and ascertain as much as I could about this, a new thing, and I don't want to just start something and charge people $1,500 if it isn't really going to accomplish things. And my feeling is that one trip a year, one inspection a year, is not necessarily going to do it. If they're following up complaints now, they might have at least a little more authority to take care of a complaint under licensure. But I would hope that we weren't just creating something else that really didn't, that cost money, that really didn't answer the problem. So I'm trying to, in my own mind, see how thorough this is going to be or what opportunity it has of actually doing the job once it's on the ground and up and running.
Senator, there are two things that I'm hoping for. One is training. When they drilled into me how important diet is, and they're feeding him an orange, and then I'm saying, now wait a minute, didn't you take the same book that I took and study it? In training to recognize some of those things, and I think if there's someone who can look over their shoulder, that my expectation is that they will adhere to the training standards that they're supposed to. And the other is just someone who can go in with some authority. Because there is no licensing of these facilities, when I did end up talking to the health division, I mean, there was no one who could go in with any authority. I spoke with his primary doctor, who told me that he'd received a number of complaints about that facility, and he was going to call the folks who owned it. And it was shortly after that we left there. So I don't know how all it was after that, but I wanted to be able to complain to someone who had the authority that meant that the facility had to listen to them. Because up to that point, I hadn't found anyone that they were willing to pay more than lip service to.
I guess I'm just amazed when they have a licensed technician that they wouldn't be out doing a little bit of individual work, because somebody had to be responsible for doing these things. And if a person's a licensed technician, I guess we do go after the manufacturer of cars once in a while, but generally we go after the driver.
Mm-hmm. All I can tell you is I've been surprised in my brief experience here when we were talking about moving Dad to Salem and putting him on dialysis here. Initially, we were told that there were no dialysis slots available in Salem. There are two dialysis facilities in Salem, and I know even the one in Astoria was nearly full, and they're running two shifts a day, 6 days a week. So there's a huge need out there that I wasn't aware of until we got involved in all of this. And I have no idea what the availability is of trained people with experience in this area.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you taking your time to come.
I'm glad to do it.
Anyone further wish to testify on House Bill 2241? Go right ahead. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee. My name is Fali Sidva, and I work for Fresenius Medical Care along with Jim Curtis, the gentleman you heard from earlier. Sorry, I didn't get my name on the sheet in time to make this a little more regular. I wanted to come in here and as a member of the industry, support the bill that is before you. I also believe, like the others who have testified before you, that there are some gaps between what HCFA regulates and what, and there are other quality oriented issues that I believe we could follow much closer with help from the state, and the opportunity to sit down with the state and then help write some of those regulations is something that we would look forward to. And as you pointed out, it is not in the bill, but we do believe that that is the general modus operandi of the state in Kathleen Smale, and we have been invited to sit down with them. I do share the concerns, as Jim Curtis pointed out and others, that the $1,500 fee is going to be borne by the dialysis facility directly, and what we do not want to see it going towards is simply more reinforcement of the existing rules. We would like to see a greater good come out of the licensure for dialysis facilities. And as you correctly pointed out, several of the issues that were brought up today would not have been mitigated or prevented were dialysis facility licensure in place even at the time. They were, as you pointed out, Chair Fisher, individual acts by employees often. However, the ability to use some of these funds for greater inspection and therefore greater education will, I believe, certainly help the entire industry along greatly. One of the concerns that was pointed out to Senator Carter was that we cannot pass this fee on to our customers. It is something that the dialysis facilities have to bear. And to follow up on the senator Senator Dukes just a few minutes ago, it is more and more difficult for us to provide access to dialysis in the outlying communities because of the cost of doing business. And adding the $1,500 fee up front is certainly one part of that. There will then be the additional burden of meeting whatever regulations the team or the group comes up with, which will certainly be another added expense. And so while we firmly support the bill, we would be very interested in seeing some funding come from the state or from the federal government, as you pointed out, as a possibility, in order to assist the dialysis facilities. I'll give you an example. Fresenius Medical Care is going to be opening a clinic in Hermiston. The patients who are in Hermiston are currently being transported at state expense across the river into Pasco Kennewick, and the Pasco Kennewick facilities are being paid state dollars to dialyze our patients there. We're going to open a clinic in Hermiston after probably 2 years of analysis because the numbers are very small. Just the fee alone there would be fairly onerous on a facility that size, not to mention, again, the additional burden. So to summarize, we support the bill wholeheartedly. We believe that licensure can only lead to more positive outcomes for the patients, and we're very pleased to be able to sit down with the state and draft those regulations. We would ask that there be some assistance with the fees and the other burdens that will accompany that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2241 and open a work session on House Bill 2241.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
There are no amendments or anything?
Don't believe so.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2241 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves House Bill 2241 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Mosley?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Senator George and Senator Shields are excused. Motion carries, and Senator Duke said she would be the carrier. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2241. Yeah, we want to go to 103. Yeah, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 103. Yes, staff can hear you.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 103 establishes that an individual insured under the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, or OMIP, does not pay premium rate of more than 125% of the standard risk as determined by the board. It also revises the method in which the OMIP determines the standard risk for premiums. As some standard background, in 1987, the medical insurance pool was developed to provide affordable health insurance to individuals denied coverage elsewhere because of a current or prior health condition, and while at the same time helping to avoid undue financial impact on state and private insurers. The board the pool provides coverage to Oregonians who have exhausted COBRA benefits or have no other portability options available to them. Premiums are collected from the insured, and assessments are charged to health insurers for expenses not covered by the premium. In 89, the pool has insured more than, since its inception, has insured more than 24,000 Oregonians who otherwise would not have health benefits. Rates are capped at a percentage above the typical portability product of the same type, which is an indemnity preferred provider of managed care. The budget for 99-01 is a little over $42 million, and is comprised of the premiums and assessments to insurers. It's operated by a citizen board of directors and is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. There are dash one amendments to this as well.
Okay. We have Barney Spade and Bruce Bishop.
Good afternoon, Chairman Fisher. For the record, I'm Barney Spade with Kaiser Permanente. I'm actually here today to represent Denise Hansel, who is Vice President of Kaiser Permanente and Chair of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, but because of travel out of state, she was unable to be here, so I'm kind of subbing for her. I can't add much more than what Mr. Berkobian added to the summary of Senate Bill 103. The purpose, the objective of the bill Ms. Hansel, as chair of OMIP and the OMIP board, were seeking through the legislation is some increased statutory flexibility for OMIP in the setting of rates for those individuals who are covered through OMIP because of portability coverage. Just to back up, as indicated by Mr. Berkobian, OMIP was created in 1987 as part of the insurance reform efforts to make the individual market work for individuals who had pre-existing conditions and could not receive coverage in the individual market. That was the primary purpose of the program beginning in the late 80s. In the second wave of insurance reform that we went through in about 1991 and then again in 95, we actually anticipated the development of the concept of insurance portability. That is, if you lost your group insurance, that you could obtain some form of portability coverage. And OMIP becomes the portability carrier of last resort, if you will, under certain circumstances where an Oregonian finds themselves without any options. This bill would allow the board the same flexibility in setting the rates for those who obtain coverage through the portability door, if you will, as they have under the statute for setting rates for people who gain coverage through OMIP because of denial of insurance in the individual market. The concepts are basically the same, that they can set rates up to 125% of a standard rate, and that standard rate would be basically tied to the type of product, portability or individual. That's the purpose of the bill. There are some other minor language changes that bring the statute current relative to the terminology of use and clarifications in the area of the relationship of the board to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. To my understanding, Rocky King, who is the administrator of OMIP, has been involved in all of the work in developing both the Dash 1 amendments and this bill, and I believe is here to testify if you want so. And we've also, the board, through its chair, Ms. Hansel, has also discussed this bill with the director of DCBS and the deputy director and head of the insurance division. I'd be happy to answer questions. Mr. Bishop is here because he helped Ms. Hansel and the chair develop the original piece of legislation.
And I gather that the Dash 1 amendments are favorable.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, here representing Kaiser Permanente. The Dash 1 amendments are the results of those discussions that Mr. Spade mentioned after we had meetings with the department. with both the director of the department and the insurance administrator. And so the Dash 1 amendments incorporate their interests and make the bill more acceptable to them. And so, yes, they are our recommendation.
Questions? You're getting off easy.
Thank you very much.
There'll be another day, I'm sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 103 and enter a work session on Senate Bill 103.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 103.
Senator Carter moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 103. Is there further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Move Senate Bill 103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And that would be as amended.
As amended, yeah. Thank you.
Senator Carter has moved Senate Bill 103 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call a roll?
Senator
Leslie?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Senator Shields and Senator George are excused. The motion carries. Would you like to carry that, Senator Carter?
I will.
Senator Carter will be the carrier. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 103. And we'll stand at ease for a moment or two. Until I can get a committee administrator back here to introduce the next bill.
Amendments on that 104 as well.
Okay.
Too quick.
If we stand at ease, do I have to bring us back to order?
Yeah.
Bring the Senate Health and Human Services Committee back to order, and we will start a public hearing on Senate Bill 104, and staff will introduce it.
Senate Bill 104 establishes an advisory committee on privacy of medical information and records, requires the committee to study the relationship between the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, better known as HIPAA, and state information privacy laws, requires the committee to recommend change of state laws to comply with federal laws, and requires the committee to report to the 72nd Legislative Assembly on the results, and it does declare an emergency effective on passage. As a little background, HIPAA establishes federal standards for the availability and portability of group and health insurance markets, amends several federal current laws in health insurance, sets rules, reforms on access, portability, availability, and other areas of health coverage. HIPAA also contains numerous tax-related provisions for health care. And included in is fraud and abuse issues, especially around privacy and electronic transfer of medical information. Each time a record is made when a person goes to the doctor, hospital, pharmacist, or uses other medical services, a record is made usually an electronic record these days. HIPAA establishes federal rulemaking to give authority to federal agency to set penalties for misuse. These become effective in 2003 and affect health plans, health care clearinghouses, and providers who conduct financial administrative functions. The rules impact consumer control over health information, boundaries on medical records and release security information, penalties for misuse and parameters for public use. A group of providers, insurers, state agencies, and other stakeholders have been meeting in the Oregon HIPAA Forum to discuss implementation of HIPAA. including public policy initiatives. They've identified several hundred statutes that will have to conform to at least minimum rules set by HIPAA, and discuss other federal laws that will interface with HIPAA privacy statements. We do have dash one amendments.
You might describe those while we're at it here. And
yeah. On page one of the printed bill, after line 17, insert the State Board of Pharmacy, I, and then J, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. In line 20, delete 4 and insert 2.
Representative Barnhart, is this what you wish to? Senate Bill 104?
Yes, sir.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Senator Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from District 40 in Eugene. This bill came to my attention via the auspices of the Oregon Psychological Association. And of course, I'm at least in general terms familiar with the summary that your administrator just finished giving you. This is an area which is extremely complex and tends to affect the consumer, consuming public, in different ways depending upon the ways in which different professionals tend to interact with them. There are very different kinds of considerations for different purposes in terms of health and mental health treatment. I have proposed an amendment, which are the dash two amendments, that would allow the appointment to the committee of a licensed mental health professional to help the committee deal with the issues that would come up in the area that this committee is intended to deal with for dealing with mental health records issues. I've also proposed another set of amendments, which unfortunately has not come back from the Legislative Council yet, which in lieu of the dash two amendments would add another capital letter amendment to appoint a member of the Oregon Psychological Association. The Oregon Psychological Association has a number of committees that work with ethical issues, with privacy issues, and would be an excellent organization for the purpose of finding somebody to assist on this committee to deal with mental health issues as they relate to confidentiality and privacy, the area that the committee's designed to work in. That's the essence of my proposal. It would add, I think, one more group that should be represented as these issues are considered, because, as I indicate, the concerns that people with who are treating with mental disorders have may be somewhat different from the concerns that would come up as a result of the other areas represented on the committee. I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Okay. So you're here to impress upon us to pass the dash two amendments.
Well, or actually, I would prefer the dash three amendments, which you haven't got yet, which would establish which would add to the capital letter items under 3A, the Oregon Psychological Association. If the committee preferred not to do that, but instead was willing to add some generic licensed mental health professional, then I would prefer the dash two amendments as a fallback position. Unfortunately, three hasn't been prepared yet. I was amazed I got two as fast as I did, but three isn't ready.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have no questions. I just I think this is a vital piece that we had overlooked in this, that is overlooked in this bill, in terms of a mental health therapist or psychologist on board.
So ultimately, we wind up with a committee of 17 if we would consider the dash three that are not here yet.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
If we were to consider even the dash twos or the dash threes, you have four additional representatives. You can break down the representation and keep it so it doesn't become unwielding.
Well, I'm guessing that out of those four could have come one from each of those ones, and we'd still have one left. However, wouldn't necessarily guarantee that they would be from that.
Right.
From that group.
Mr. Sherman?
Yes.
To keep the number where it is now, you can just, instead of the governor having the prerogative to do four additional representatives, maybe appointed at the discretion of the governor, you could do the psychologist and mental health therapist, and then two could come from the governor.
Yeah, and that's a may, so it wouldn't necessarily have to be, so that's a discretion.
Right.
Yeah, we're cutting it down to two. So we'd only really be adding, two.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions, Representative Barnhart?
No, I feel fine, but Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to think it makes sense to request, to consider his request to wait for the dash three amendments. If that's your pleasure.
Yes, that's what I intend to do. Okay. We'll wait to have further public hearing when you get the dash three amendments, but would you get them as quickly as possible?
Well, we'll send them right
you
down.
You did so well on the dash two. Let's see how you can continue that good work on the dash three, and we'll get this back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make sure they're sent down as soon as I get them.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 104 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2253. Ask staff to introduce it.
Thank you, Senator. House Bill 2253 expands membership of the Interagency Coordinating Council to address hunger in Oregon. As some background, the Interagency Coordinating Council, or ICC, was established under the Housing and Community Services Department to meet the problems of hunger in Oregon. Members of the council represent Housing, Community Services, Department of Education, Department of Agriculture, Department of Human Services, Adult Family Services, and Senior Disabled Services. Currently, representatives from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and Department of Corrections do sit at the table as well, but are not statutory members. Additionally, the council has discussed adding representatives from Employment Council and the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. The established Oregon Hunger Task Relief Force consists of a diverse group of private sector, for-profit, not-for-profit food-providing organizations, legislators, and others. The task force reports to the ICC. Funding for the task force comes through budget agreements with members of the ICC. Participating agencies contribute $6,000 annually to the task force.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have the director of housing here. We'll ask him to come forward, and Patty Whitney. Good afternoon, sir.
Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Bob Repine, director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. With me today is Patty Whitney Wise, who is the chair, director, fearless leader of the Hunger Task Force that we work with on behalf of the ICCH. We're here to support House Bill 2253 that you have in front of you at this moment. It is a simple bill. It adds the Department of Corrections, Economic Community Development, and the State Commission on Children and Families to those already agencies identified that work on the Hunger Task Force activities through ICCH. Mr. Chairman, just a brief trip back to nostalgia. The task force was formed in 1989. The Hunger Council was created in 1991. The members that were listed in the statutes today, or those at that time, seemed to be the most obvious and apparent agencies that had some relationship to hunger issues in the state of Oregon. Since 1998, after receiving a letter from the governor to encourage me as the director to once again institute the ICCH activities that had been put on the shelf for numerous numbers of years by some of my predecessors to become more active in the hunger issues around Oregon, as this bill suggests. We convened those members and did a outreach to other members that we believe through agencies had reasons or responsibility to be at the table with us. What is the result of that outreach is the three agencies that you have in front of you today: Department of Corrections, the Children and Family Commission, Commission on Children and Family, and the Economic Community Development Department. Each one of them have or relate to some form of a stakeholder or some responsibility in and around the issues of hunger for the state of Oregon. So just to bring our family together, as this mentioned in the staff report, these individuals have been participating with us since 1998. So they've got a three-year track record with us of being good partners. And this is just a way to codify their relationship with us in the statutes for the purpose of showing that they have a vested interest in issues around hunger for the state of Oregon.
Ms. Whitney Wise, I apologize. I saw the hyphen there, and I thought that was initials of some department or something that you represented. I didn't realize it was
the Wise Department. Yes. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the Executive Director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. Chair Fisher and committee members, I'm pleased to be here to support this legislation. I'm just going to give you a few of the accomplishments of the ICCH since it's been reestablished in 1998. The ICCH did come up with a definition of hunger and food insecurity against which to measure programs here in Oregon. They built on the task force work with the population survey and paid for a series of six questions on the latest population survey, as well as helping to establish a hunger benchmark with the progress board. So we now have a measure against which we are operating in Oregon. They also commissioned a study with through the Energy Assistance Program and gathered information from other related surveys, including the Oregon Food Bank Hunger Factor Survey. What we're beginning to do is build a picture of who it is that's hungry in Oregon, what are the kinds of services they need, and then what are the public policy options that we need to be moving forward so that people are fed, and therefore, especially for young families, those children grow healthy and are able to learn and be productive citizens in our society. Also, just recently, ICCH agreed to pay for those same six food insecurity questions from the USDA National Survey on the Health Risk Behavior Survey. So again, we're getting more regional and local data that where we can look at individuals and their circumstances and what it is that's preventing them from getting enough food to eat for their families. We know some of those reasons, but we want a little bit more specific information on if there are areas in Oregon that are particularly hard hit. They have also, ICCH members being state directors have moved forward fairly quickly with some very major policy changes that we're really pleased with. Adult and Family Services has moved forward with some waivers in the food stamp program that have allowed more participation and simplifying the program so that more of those working families who are eligible are receiving benefits. We have an outreach initiative that recently received the Secretary of Agriculture Glickman's Pyramid of Excellence Award nationally for our efforts in food stamp outreach and the increases that we achieved in East Multnomah County where we piloted the program. That has now gone statewide. The ICCH has supported increased staffing at the Department of Education so that they can do additional outreach and programs for children during the summer after school. Programs as well. So these are expanding existing federal dollar programs to more children who are in need in the state of Oregon. And we've also worked with the governor's office on these above initiatives and given him a complete list of what are the things that families need in order to provide for their basic needs, including food. Last but not least, recently the governor's office asked us to put together a document on how to better coordinate programs for hunger programs in Oregon throughout state agencies. And that document relayed five areas for work. One is data collection and analysis. Another is nutrition education. Third is outreach. Fourth is monitoring. And a fifth is program improvements. And through the ICCH, committees on each of those five areas have been formed, and people are working on addressing those issues. Just one simple one as an example: in many rural areas, there are family daycare homes who could receive some help with providing meals for the children they care for. For instance, if you're in Christmas Valley, there isn't a sponsor out there, and so somebody, in order to come out and inspect your home, would have to drive 3 or 4 hours. We're looking at a relationship with from the Department of Education and the Adult and Family Services, who may have a monitor for other programs out in that area who could go perform that function for the Department of Education, sort of a cross-departmental kind of use of personnel, and then the program can operate in the home. So those kinds of where agencies have monitors for various food-related programs or health facilities, of being able to use them cross-program areas, we can reach more of our rural areas. That's just one example of where there could be a program improvement across agency boundaries. So I urge your support for this bill. We've enjoyed very much working with the state agencies and feel like we're making great progress.
I'm familiar with this, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Senator Carter, did you wish
to? No, I was just going to say I'm familiar with this.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Musgrove. I'm just looking for a little more background. Where we're seeing the increase in hunger our communities, is it, are you seeing more in the rural areas, and or is it still?
There is analysis happening right now. The first year with the use of the six questions on the population survey was this most recent one. The general data is out, and the regional data is now being analyzed, and we should have that within a couple of months. I can answer that better for you at that time. Anecdotally, and from other surveys that have been done through the food bank and the energy survey, it's pretty consistent. Both rural and urban areas are finding that hunger is high, and you may be aware that we were ranked number one in hunger 2 years ago by USDA with their food insecurity survey. That is in the hunger report that I passed out to you mentions that, and may I just add that the ICCH helped to fund that hunger report so that we could get it out in a broader distribution throughout the state so people begin to make those connections, what's happening and what can be done to help people.
Sure. Senator Mesrilli.
I don't have a question, but just a comment. I got some figures the other day, and I'm not sure, it might have been from your department, Mr. Repine, but indicating that Coos County is the fourth highest percentage of their population below the federal poverty level. I believe Josephine County was even worse. I think there's Coos County was 17.1, Josephine was 18%, and then there was a couple of Eastern Oregon counties. But I think we've really got a very serious problem when you see population centers like that that have that level of poverty. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is, I would expect Josephine County, a lot of families leaving the area, which leaves our schools in really, really tough shape. So it affects a broad spectrum of services. But. So I'm interested just how the demographics are laying out.
And Chair Fisher and Senator Messerly, also I might add that in our food stamp outreach project, we did look at a number of indicators in Oregon counties in targeting five areas this year for intensive work where participation isn't as high as it could be. There are a lot of families eligible for food stamps not participating, and there's a lot of need. And Coos Curry is one of the five target areas this year.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Earlier this year, I wrote a piece of some information on the floor under remonstrances on this issue of hunger and where we are nationally as being number one on our list. And I don't think, because so many of us in Oregon are in the workplace, we don't think of so many of our citizens being hungry. But when you look at, and I'm sure Representative Repine has an appreciation of this, but we used to work a lot on issues in rural Oregon and inner city Portland, and because they had so much in common, and hunger was one of them. And under your leadership, even though you've gotten after being gone for just 2 days, already. We were able to work on some of those issues collectively and sought resolutions to them. And so I'm glad to see, and I feel very safe with the fact that Representative Repine is, former Representative Repine and now the Director of Housing and Human Services will work diligently in helping to alleviate this problem and bringing it closer to the attention of the legislature. So I'm glad to see him here today with our colleagues so that, because many of us work and have food on our table, we don't realize that there are others who don't even have a table to have food on, even if they had it. So certainly is important to me. Thank you for your work.
Mr. Chairman, if I can make a comment.
Right,
first of all, I appreciate Senator Carter's, I don't know if she was reintroducing me to the legislature, reminding why I'm not a legislator anymore. one of the issues that I think has become real clear to me in my role as the Director of Housing and Community Services, obviously housing is a principal focus for us, but you cannot separate the two issues. If you think about the cost of living that usually causes the highest burden on a family, the two top issues are rent and their food. And usually between those two, tough choices are made, and generally what happens is that in order to maintain paying a rent or their costs for their housing, they will forgo food for their family, mm-hmm. and or try to find some other forms of resources in the way of food banks that are around the state that can help them maybe bridge some days or some portions of that month where they can't have been in a position to purchase food. So there's a really tight correlation between what we do in the housing arena and the hunger issues. And along with that is you throw even the bigger complexity of poverty as a whole into it and try to figure out what are the dynamics that causes poverty to take place in areas that, for all practical reasons, if you look at them economically, it would suggest to you that there is no poverty issues. But in fact, there are great poverty disparities in very viable portions of our state where you would think everything should be well. Well, you also find that they have the same, or if not higher, equally as high poverty rankings, and then along with that you find hunger issues that parallel that. So it's been an amazing correlation, and I think the challenge has been well received by the ICCH Council, the Hunger Council, and we don't, quite frankly, it's been a very, I think, robust discussion. Nobody is there saying everybody's doing it right. We understand our roles and responsibilities, but also realize that every issue is fair game for discussion. And as Patty indicated to you, as an example of one that just recently came out, that with the assistance of AFS, if you can imagine, the food stamp application form for the state of Oregon was 14 pages.
Wow.
And I'm talking 14 pages of relatively small print. So most people who would be receiving a very little, again, Senator Meserly, we think food stamp recipients are all receiving the maximum. Many times our seniors are eligible for relatively smaller stipends of food stamp assistance, maybe $30 to $50, possibly less, but they are not going to subject themselves to sitting down and filling out a 14-page form that takes hours to do to get a couple of bucks at the end of the day. Through the work of the task force and some reinventing and putting resources together, that form today is 4 pages this year. And not only is it 4 pages this year, it's actually going through its next iteration, and when it's all done, it'll only be 2 pages long.
And people can see it.
And people can read it and understand it, and all the same information that had to be on the 14 pages is still on those 2 pages. But what you do is you take now those seniors who might be only have been eligible for $20 or $30, they'll come in and maybe take the 10 or 15 minutes, and they don't feel like that there's a level of humility having to sit somewhere in a public lobby some area to fill out a 14-page form to get some small amount of food assistance that they're eligible for. And so that will also stimulate and give all the citizens of Oregon a fair opportunity to find an accessible way to get to the food stamp program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I guess that about ends the testimony. Did anyone else wish to testify on?
No, they're all with us.
Okay. We got your backup troops just in case, huh? Yeah, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2253 and...
Mr. Chairman?
There were no amendments on it.
No amendments?
And I will open a work session on House Bill 2253.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2253 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves House Bill 2253 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Mesrley?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. And again, Senator George and Senator Shields are excused. I believe I'm going to have Senator Shields carry this. He's very interested in these issues.
That's
and,
right.
Not being here today, we'll just get him involved in this.
I think that's a wonderful idea, Mr. Chairman.
Motion carries, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2253. And thank the committee for
that's what he gets for being in Washington, D.C.
attention today. We're adjourned.
Andrew.